Welcome to the Dialectic with the Rajput and the Wasp. We'll crack on today with a very important topic, a topic that is dominating world headlines from BBC News to Al Jazeera to Indian newspapers to British newspapers, of course, and American ones. How the Israel-Hamas war is now changing the world. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, good morning. I guess it still is where I am.
Morning. I'm in Washington looking out at the snow. Yeah, I suspect there's most snow in Boston.
There's some snow, yeah. There's some snow. Enough that I had to have the snowplow company come instead of me spending 5 hours shoveling, or six. I'm easily distracted by snow. Well, okay. Today we're talking about the Israel-Hamas war, whatever it's coming to be called, I don't really know, and how, and this will sound melodramatic, but I think that's the, for all the attention everyone worldwide is paying on this, I think there are changes occurring in the world as a result of this conflict that are only dimly perceived, since we're all naturally focused on the shiny moving object, which is the fighting, the war itself, which is quite significant. I'm not in any way diminishing the significance of the fighting, but the structural implications of the war, I think, frankly, are even greater, which is alarming.
I would concur. There's a great game of geopolitical chess going on. And one of the key actors right now is Iran, which seems to be beating everyone else in that chess game right now.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's chess. I fear that it's roulette. perhaps it's both. And it truly is both. Everyone thinks they're playing chess. You know, one of the stock lines is that Americans, opponents play chess and the Americans play checkers or poker, and implying that we have a short-term perspective and so on. And there's a lot of truth to that. In any event, I think there are two issues or two frameworks that we want to discuss, or from which we should look at the Israel-Hamas war and how it is changing the world. And very simply, they are the regional changes, influences, and consequences of the conflict, and then the larger global changes, which are, I have come to think, world-changing and will be lasting. That sounds perhaps melodramatic, given that the Gaza conflict has not spilled out too much into a regional war directly involving superpowers. I don't think that is likely, but already, as we know, things have spilled out and the consequences are great. So first, let's talk about not specifically what's happening in the conflict, that there were bombs launched by F-16s here, or Hamas has launched a missile there and so on, but what the regional changes are. I think that Hamas and Iran have succeeded in their at least intermediate objective with the October 7 attack across the wall, and that was to re-inject the Palestinian issue into the front of the minds and concerns of the regional players and the world, more the regional players initially.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the regional players, they don't care too much about the Palestinians. The Saudi ruling elite, the ruling family, is much more concerned about preserving its hold on power. MBS Mohammed bin Salman wants to neuter, if not kill, all his potential rivals. And of course, a part of that ensuring the hold on power means that he has to provide jobs and growth and yada yada. Ipso facto, making peace with Israel makes sense. Also, because I'm told that Israelis are guaranteeing, or let's say, if not guaranteeing, overseeing the security of many people in the regime, apparently. So he certainly doesn't want his apple cart or his cart to be upset over Palestinians. And the same is true for Arab leaders around the Middle East and North Africa. So they don't really care about the Palestinians, and that includes neighboring Egypt, Sisi.
Right. This has been one of the great consistent points of politics in the Middle East and in the world since 1948, which is that whatever crisis has occurred in the region concerning the Palestinians or the region, the Palestinian one can predict, because it has always been true, that the Palestinians will be the losers. They are, with the Kurds, some of the great losers in history. And I'm not being pejorative at all. I mean, this is a terrible situation, but every war, every agreement, just about since 1948, has been either at the expense of or without regard to the consequences for the Palestinians. And so Hamas's attack, and I, one should know if one has ever listened to two words I've ever said, am not a supporter or an admirer of Hamas at all. I mean, that's a litote. It's the opposite is absolutely the case. But they have succeeded now in making the Palestinian issues central to regional politics and to the world. So to the point where there are mass demonstrations in Sydney, Australia, and every other place between Sydney and Oslo concerning the struggle and the problems, the injustices in which the Palestinians have to live. So Hamas has succeeded. Also, however, Hamas is not a puppet of, but certainly influenced by, or supported by, we can at least say, Iran. And the war now has re-injected Iran, not that they were out of influence in the region, but it has enhanced Iran as a central player slash troublemaker from everyone else's perspective, but certainly an influence in the region, because Hamas is not alone. Hamas is a surrogate of Iran, as Hezbollah is to Israel's north in Lebanon, and as the Houthi are to the region's south, as we'll talk about at length, with what they are doing in the Red Sea, disrupting not just global economic traffic in order to pressure, frankly, the United States more than Israel in the Gazan fighting, but capitals and economies everywhere in the world.
So you bring a very important point. So far, Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis were striking targets. There was a civil war in Yemen where the Saudis struck the Houthis, and the Houthis managed to withstand that attack. Now they are following the money. They are hitting global trade. As we know, we have covered all the numbers in the past. 40% of Asia-Europe traffic passes through the Red Sea. It has two choke points. One is in the north, the Suez Canal, and the other is Bab el-Mandab. And the Houthis' stronghold is right next to Bab el-Mandab. So as long as they have enough drones and missiles, they can be a continual nuisance, like a mosquito that is buzzing in your ear. And companies, shipping companies, insurance companies, and all businesses don't want uncertainty. They don't want to have to deal with drones and missiles. So they are going around the Cape of Good Hope, which means that something that probably took 13 days could now take 31 or more.
And so, it did cost an insurance, if I am not garbling my figures, to for a container ship to go from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean or vice versa, $1,500 on average, which now costs $4,000 to go around the Cape of Good Hope, and as well as the increased costs in transportation, the loss of time, the effects on just-in-time, the stocking for businesses or in inventories that one hasn't had to keep or now needs to but cannot, and so on. So the consequences at present are relatively minor and contained, but will play out just like an interest rate rise takes some time to play out. And it has a much larger consequence that we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to make another point that you touched upon, Atul, and that the Houthis haven't discovered but are effectively waging the lesson that all weaker powers will grant the Houthi the attributes of a state for the moment, but it doesn't have to even be a state. That they've opponents of major powers have learned in the last 100 years, and that is asymmetric warfare. And the Saudis discovered this for 9 years, I guess it was, in their effort to suppress, to defeat the Houthis in Yemen. The Americans have repeatedly had to discover this problem. You choose the war that the Americans have fought, Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, the French in Indochina, the British in, even in the Boer War, and the Americans in the Philippines 120 years ago, on and on and on. A conventional military great power, frankly, cannot really succeed except at an immense cost in imposing its will on a dispersed, non-geographically centered power motivated by ideology and willing to engage in, as you said, mosquito bites, which cumulatively can bring down a behemoth. And this is what's happening.
So when you talk about the asymmetric warfare, I'd like to point out to those who are watching us and listening to us that a Houthi drone strike, even a relatively expensive one, costs $16,000. And to shoot that down, the missile costs over $1 million. And so here you are hemorrhaging cash, because this is not even counting the fuel costs of operating the fleet, the logistical strains it is putting on the US and UK Navy, the usage of equipment now tied up in the Red Sea, which could have been used elsewhere. So we are seeing this extraordinary increase in costs just by a minor action by the Houthis. So it costs the Iranians very little to keep the U.S. tied up in the Red Sea.
And it puts the, in a way, the onus, the decision on the United States and the U.S.'s partners as to whether the Gazan regional, not even regional, the localized Gazan war, we'll call it, will expand and become a regional one. And no power, I don't believe any power, Iran, the United States, Turkey, China, India, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, et cetera, wants the fighting in Gaza to extend and become regionalized, which would be cataclysmic. However, the Houthis have achieved, and Iran has achieved so far, a striking success, frankly, by putting the burden for restraint and reaction on the United States, and broadening the focus of attention from the ignored Palestinians to now making their issue central. And for Iran, this has, it might not have them become the arbiter of how things will play out, but it now makes them a player with more influence than prior to October 7. They were a player prior to October 7, but in the entire region, it has reinvigorated their they cannot be bypassed in how this issue plays out. And now the Palestinians are no longer ignored. The Abrahamic Accords, that was the triumph of the Trump administration, of course, it did regionalize peace agreements or broaden them at the complete cost of the Palestinians. That is no longer the case. I don't think that the Gazan war, Hamas's action, the Houthi actions, Iran's support will ultimately derail a Saudi-Israel peace agreement, but it has certainly delayed it, and the conditions of it will probably evolve as a result of what's happened or is happening now in Gaza and in the Red Sea with the Houthis.
So, quick getting into details a little bit. The big powers in the region are, of course, Saudi Arabia, which has huge amounts of oil. Saudi Arabia is a Sunni kingdom. It is the keeper of the protector of the most holy shrines, pilgrimages for Muslims, Mecca and Medina. So it has a lot of cultural hegemony in some ways in the Sunni world, which is the majority of the Muslim world. Almost, I think, 85-90% of the global population of Muslims is Sunni. Turkey is the former imperial master of the Middle East, and Turkey has political Islam, which is often seen as an example for much of the region. And so you have Turkey and Saudi as the traditional leaders of the Islamic world. And now, of course, Iran, despite being Shia, has thrust itself into the picture because the Arab populations love, the Arab street loves what Iran is doing and the Houthis are doing and Hezbollah and Hamas are doing. So, ironically, the Sunni populations of the Arab world are increasingly viewing their own leaders as Judases who have sold out for 13 pieces of silver from the evil Jews and the satanic Americans. And now, the leaders, and the more I speak to our authors in the region, the more I get this feedback, is that the leaders are increasingly nervous. They are caught between Sila and Charybdis. On the one hand, they do not want war with Israel. They do not want a war which would destroy their economies. Their economies are, in any case, in a parlous state. But on the other hand, they cannot ignore the Arab street, which is calling for justice to Palestinians, end to genocide, and shedding every drop of their blood for Al-Aqsa, the great mosque in Jerusalem. They cannot ignore that sentiment either. And Iran, therefore, feels emboldened to have to conduct strikes in Iraq, Syria, and now even Pakistan.
Which is, if ever there was a proof that a regional power had become more powerful, influential, consequential, and felt free to pursue its own objectives compared to the world that we all lived in until recent years, that is the proof. I mean, who with impunity could go around sending missiles into one country or another? It was really only the superpower or the superpower's allies. But that's not the case now, as Atul just pointed out. And there's a tremendous irony in the other point that Atul just made, which is that the Shia power, the rival of Saudi Arabia and the Sunni, both theologically and for pure political influence in the region among Muslims and in the region in general, now has the growing support of the quote Arab street, which really means the majority of private citizens, Sunni Muslims around the world. Because who has done anything for the Palestinians on one hand, and then who is the puppet proving the point of, frankly, Osama bin Laden from 20 years ago? Who is the puppet of the imperialist, infidel United States? And it's the quote corrupt unquote regimes of the Sunni states, which is really why Saudi Arabia has been so chary, unwilling to associate itself with the coalition the U.S. is organizing to try to maintain the freedom of navigation in the Red Sea from Houthi attacks, because that would just so perfectly play into the narrative that here, once again, these spineless puppets are doing the imperialists' bidding.
And Saudi Arabia is in a bind, because Saudi Arabia did fight a full war against the Houthis. Saudi Arabia did throw the kitchen sink at them. Saudi Arabia also turned the screws on Qatar. Saudi Arabia tried all it could to be the dominant power, and now it has kissed and made up with the Iranians, of course, thanks to the mediators, the Bahrainis and the Omanis, and of course, China.
China.
And now, Mohammed bin Salman, a man who had a critic chopped up in Istanbul, this man with little mercy, is hesitating joining the US-led coalition to secure freedom of navigation in the Red Sea, which is in Saudi interest, is very keen not to upset a potential peace deal with the Houthis, because the Saudis are tired of fighting, and he cannot be seen to be striking the Houthis, who are waging a jihad against the evil Jew. And so in a way, Saudi Arabia is in a bind. Not that they care much about it. They are still conducting football matches. The Barcelona and Real Madrid played in Saudi Arabia recently. Cristiano Ronaldo is there. Life is good. They may even have professional golf in the desert. Of course, irrigated by water, it won't be desert where the golf course is. But the point is, despite all of that, the Saudis do feel the strain.
You alluded to, or you mentioned China, and we won't quite transition to global issues yet, but it is really important to be aware that the Houthi action coming as a supposed support for the Palestinians and the pressure on the Americans, the pressure at the Israelis in Gaza, really presents an opening to Russia and especially to China. The U.S. is sending warships once again to the Red Sea. I think that it is a necessary step, but one has to be aware of not just the optics, but the proof that that will be taken to provide to the perspective we just touched upon in the region, particularly among Muslims and former. You know, the colonialism is dead, but its echoes continue to reverberate. The former colonized powers, countries, or societies is more important, who view the quote normative system as the legacy, therefore disreputable and to be rejected, often a legacy of the colonial era of the West, of the Christian powers. And who brought peace between the Sunni and the Shia, between Iran and Saudi Arabia? And who hasn't sent soldiers and troops, as they will remind you all the time? And that is China. So one of the consequences, which we'll get to in a moment, certainly has been that it gives an opening for China to build upon its legitimate substantive success in brokering the peace deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. But on a regional note, I believe the big risk for the regimes in the Middle East is Arab uprisings too. There are thousands taking to the streets, chanting pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas slogans. The police cannot move against them, because if they do, then the regimes will face a backlash. And when you have so many people on the street, rulers in repressive regimes start getting nervous because they are not just going to talk about the Palestinians when they are on the street. They're going to talk about how effete, how corrupt, and how collaborative with the West their Judas-like rulers are. And this is bad news for everyone in the region, every repressive leader in the region, whether it is General Sisi in Egypt, or whether it is, and this hasn't happened much in the Gulf, but whether it is certainly the King of Jordan, all of this is destabilizing.
So far, Hamas's attack of October 7th, the Houthis' ostensible support by their attacking shipping in the Red Sea has been, broadly speaking, a success for Iran. It has avoided, everyone has avoided so far, a regional war. But as we all know, this, it's not imaginary. The concern is not ill-founded that all this could easily spin out of control. Most of you will know that the U.S., the Houthi and other Iranian-supporting elements from Hezbollah to groups in Iraq and Syria have attacked American facilities and personnel over 120 times since October 7. There have been these increasing attacks by the Houthi in the Red Sea, and now the United States has three times responded with apparently substantial attacks, not just a cruise missile, but 100 different targets or something to that effect in Yemen. And as Atul mentioned, which is really unprecedented, I think, Iran now feels free to launch its missiles in three different countries, was it? In Pakistan, in
apparently
Iraq, and in
Syria, and Pakistan. And the Pakistan incident is because the ship, the Indian ship that was, or the so-called Indian ship that was struck, Pentagon claims it was struck by Iran, Iran claims it was Pakistan, and Jai Shankar, India's foreign minister, visited Iran, and then Iran made the case they hadn't visited. And of course, they asked Pakistan to take action against Jaish-ul-Adl, which is a Sunni-Baluchi separatist organization. Now, the Baluchs are divided between Pakistan and Iran. And remember that in an earlier avatar, the Mughal Empire and the Persian Empire fought three legendary battles over Kandahar. So Sunni and Shia powers have, empires have fought over these borderlands forever. And a Sunni state, Pakistan, has Baluchs. A Shia state has Baluchs. There are Baluchs who want to be free from Pakistan. There are Baluchs who want to be free from Iran. And the ones who want freedom from Iran have been struck in Pakistan. As if this wasn't confusing enough, every single state in the Middle East is a patchwork of different ethnicities. So all of those can of worms could open up.
So it certainly has made the region more complex, less stable. It also, and this is a way to segue, I think, perhaps to the global consequences, yeah. Has given an opening to China, which will probably be wise enough not to dash in, but to bask in the aura of good feelings and to act when possible. But all of that is quite different from the world that we've always lived in. And it also, before we move completely globally, we've touched upon Iran now sending missiles into other countries. But that raises a lot of, it poses a dilemma for India, which is not just a regional power, but a nascent true global power. Because it would be, and here Atul, of course, I'll defer to your thoughts on this, but it would seem, it being the missile strike in Pakistan, would seem to offer an opening or perhaps pressure even for Iran and India to be, if not aligned, more harmonious in their policies, since Pakistan is a headache in Afghanistan and elsewhere for India and for Iran. And yet that contradicts India's interest and stated intentions in maintaining the free flow of navigation and trade in the Red Sea, so important that India has dispatched three of its own warships to do, I'm not sure what, but ostensibly to help maintain the peaceful flow of trade, which is quite important for India, perhaps even more important in the Red Sea than other countries, and yet is in contradiction with the some pressure, not pressure, but inclination now to not criticize Iran necessarily. Am I off on that?
Absolutely true. And I would say both India and China have a delicate balancing act. China has urged Pakistan to demonstrate restraint because China is trying very hard to have good relations with both Iran and Pakistan. Of course, India has a delicate balancing act because it wants Iran's tacit, if not overt, support against Pakistan. The Sunni regime, the fundamentalist Sunni regime in Afghanistan, the Taliban, is a headache not only for Iran. Iran is obviously more emotionally and strategically involved because it has a border. And of course, there have been clashes as well between the Iranian border guards and the Taliban fighters. And the persecution of Hazaras by the Taliban doesn't help. Hazaras are a Shia population in Western Afghanistan. And the Taliban, shall we say, have not been treating them entirely justly. Many of their leaders have been killed. They are persecuted for their Shia beliefs and yada yada. So, of course, India wants trade with Europe. After all, trade through the Red Sea hurts Europe and Asia much more than the U.S., because that is the main waterway for Europe and the U.S. And obviously, India has to balance its trade with Europe along with its strategic need for Iran. And China has to balance its good relations both with Pakistan and with Iran, both of which offer outlets to the sea. And have different strategic uses. Iran is a source of energy. Iran is a source of pressure against the U.S. And Pakistan is a source of pressure against India. So for China, they have to balance both these countries too. So lots of delicate balancing act. It's very chaotic, which moves us on to the global implications. And the global implications are no less chaotic. Harvard, which is where Glenn studied not too long ago, as you can see, he's very youthful. And Harvard has a lot of supporters of the Palestinian cause. Similarly, if you look at editorials in The Guardian, many make the point that, look, Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, disobeyed international law forever, cocked a snook at the Obama White House, built settlements willy-nilly, ignored the International Court of Justice, tried to steamroll the opposition and bring in judicial reforms, which have been struck down by the Supreme Court. And yet the Democratic White House was powerless to act against a Trumpian Israeli figure who is backed by political leaders who argue for Palestinian genocide, no less. So there is a very strong representation of the Israeli far right in Bibi Netanyahu's government. And so there's a lot of division now in Western capitals as to how to deal with Israel. And an Israeli friend of mine said, the long war for us was never in Palestine. The long war is the war of narrative in the West. Israel needs the backing of the US and even Europe. And for us to lose that narrative war is the biggest blow that we have faced since October 7th. Over to you, Glenn. What do you think on this line of reasoning? You're sitting very close to Harvard.
Well, the devil is in the details of Houthi and Iranian missiles and the Netanyahu coalition beholden to and frankly shaped definitively by the extreme conservative, ultra-Orthodox right in Israeli politics. But the consequences from my perspective, and those things are consequential. If you're bombed by a whatever missile, that's pretty consequential. And the effects it has, as we've talked about internationally, are substantial. And if you're a Palestinian or an Israeli, what the far right has been doing in Israel is consequential. But frankly, I think globally, there are even more substantial, lasting implications of the missiles, the far right, Hamas's attack. And they are what we generally don't see or are not aware of because the shifts are more subtle and more profound. And the first is one of the big losers of Hamas's attack is Ukraine. The United States is just about paralyzed politically, independent of everything we've been talking about. But it is dramatically, exponentially harder for the Biden administration to provide support, military, financial, and other, to Ukraine in the current context because the Republican opposition or the Republican Party is itself in its own in a civil war, but dominated by, frankly, a crypto-fascist perspective and isolationist movement and leader. So for
Donald
Ukraine,
Trump has just won the Iowa primary. He got 51% of the vote. Ron DeSantis, for all the money he put in, for all his so-called ground game, got only 21% of the vote. And Nikki Haley was further behind, although she may win in New Hampshire. But right now, it is Donald Trump who's leading the polls. And the United States Congress has two chambers. The lower chamber is the House of Representatives. And the Speaker is not particularly gung-ho about funding Ukraine. And so Ukraine
who,
very
it's
much
little
is,
known, but who did receive financial funding and support from Russia. When that came out, he said, oh, I didn't realize this, and he probably didn't, and he gave the money back.
I didn't catch that. Could you educate us about this money from
Russia? I actually don't know
the
details very well, but apparently, yeah. I should be able to cite chapter and verse, and I cannot for this one. But my understanding is that among many, many politicians, I'm not saying that Michael Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, a Republican, is a puppet of or tool of Russia. I suspect he's hostile to Russia. But it appears to be true that he did receive funding. And why? And this is a tangential thing. This is a subject for a different talk, which we could do. But one of the Russian intelligence services, the two things being indistinguishable, objectives is to sow discord, paralysis, and disaffection in the American electorate and political system. And so therefore you would support, if you're a Russian intelligence officer, someone who is on the extreme of either party, because that would create tensions. And this is the sensible thing for the Russians to do, which they do quite successfully in any event.
So to close the loop, they may be using this issue to sow further dissension and discord.
Oh, I don't think there's any. I can't show you the KGB, the FSB's document, with their plan to do so, but that is in line with standard Russian intelligence operations targeting the United States. Absolutely, I don't think there's any question about that, and they've had great success. They're very, very good as an intelligence service. But let's put them aside for the moment. The consequences for Ukraine are existential. It doesn't the attack in Hamas, the diversion of focus and resources of the United States, and the increased difficulty for the Biden administration in carrying out any policy is directly problematic to the point where it could be existential for Ukraine. Another consequence of the Hamas attack globally is how, as you pointed out, Atul, it divides the United States domestically. Many of the left-wing supporters of the Democratic Party are quite hostile to the Biden administration's policies of lockstep support for the Netanyahu administration, which is, as we said, carrying out the policies of the far right in the Israeli structure, the ultra-Orthodox right, making it impossible for any solution to the Palestinian-Israeli problem other than, and some Israeli leaders have actually said this, the elimination of the Palestinians in Gaza, which is shocking, but they are trying to carry it out, some of them.
So they could push them all to Egypt and pay
Right.
Egypt a lump sum money, and then everything would be fine. They could live in Sinai, which there aren't that many people in Sinai.
No, and some of these Israeli leaders are talking about settlements, Jewish settlements to come in the liberated territory of Gaza, which is, I raise my hands in astonishment.
Ariel Sharon, lest people forget, took out the Jewish settlements from Gaza, and that was because they were overextending Israeli forces. So
So
to put
the
settlements back in might be a bit too aggressive.
I would think. So the left of the Democratic Party is now criticizing its own leader, the President of the United
Yeah. And
States.
saying stop the invasion.
Stop the invasion. The right of the Republican Party, which really now is the Republican Party, criticizes, of course, President Biden and the Democrats for being, quote, complicit with Hamas, weak, and they acknowledged, and this is another quote, the Hamas attack is a great opportunity to criticize Democrats, thereby increasing, unquote, the paralysis of the United States government. Now, that domestically for Americans, that's significant. Regionally, this is significant. But even more broadly, as I'm trying to get to, it is lastingly significant and has an effect. So all aid to Ukraine has been frozen. It makes Biden's reelection less likely and more problematic. That would be, this is, and I truly don't believe this is a partisan statement. Would be catastrophic for the world because it would lead to. There's always been a strong current of isolationism in the United States. And at the least that one can say, the Republican Party now, put aside its fascistic as attributes, is isolationist. And that would lead to U.S. disengagement. And with disengagement would come a vacuum. And in a vacuum, something will fill it. And what will fill it is already happening. And has happened in a way that's changed the world, and that is the rise of these regional nascent global powers in influence, in regional and global influence, in shaping how the world functions. And they are Russia, of course, China more than anything, and the Middle Eastern powers, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, and the nascent global power India, which leads to
India is not
the
in the Middle East. It's a South Asian power.
so. Well, nascent global power is it, which leads to de facto a world which has spheres of influence and transactional relations bilaterally among all powers, rather than a halting, imperfect, but nonetheless real shaping of international transactions, be they economic, political, or military, from a normative system. You can put paid to the law of the sea, because you would have China imposing its view of maritime commerce in the South China Sea and the United States and the Caribbean, and who knows who in the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea, and on and on. And this would change everything from the cost of pencils that are imported someplace to how a war starts, is regulated, fought, and concluded. This de facto is happening, and it is inevitable. It's not so much the decline of the United States as it is the rise of other countries economically, therefore politically, therefore militarily, more powerful than before, and free actors. If India wants to do something, it can. If Iran wants to send missiles into Pakistan now, it can. And no one can stop it. And this leads to this increasing chaos and sphere of influence world, which is a reversion to the world at least pre-1945, pre-World War I, 1914, and I would say even pre-Pax Britannica, going back to a world where there was no real halting arbiter of international affairs, which I don't think any of us have ever lived in. And of course, an equation with multiple variables is much harder to solve than one with fewer variables. And finding an equilibrium in such a situation, which doesn't lead to friction, therefore to clashes, it will be much, much harder, if not impossible. And this is, I think, one of, it's not only because of what's happening in Gaza, but Gaza is yet another chip taken out of this structure. Just as I talked before about, and people smile because it seems so incongruous, the increased influence of China in the Solomon Islands, that's an indication of the growing multipolarity of the international system, where the United States doesn't set the rules. There are no rules. Might makes influence, and therefore that makes right. And that is what is progressively happening, whether it's in the Solomon Islands, in Hamas being able to attack Gaza, supported by the Houthis in the Red Sea, and Russia being able, with progressive likelihood of some success, to invade in the center of Europe, which is where this normative system was most relevant or embraced. And I think these are what were the changes we're living, and the implications globally to Houthis launching missiles against a container ship.
So the Houthis could be the Hamas and Houthis and Hezbollah and Iran could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. What you're saying is that not since 1805, since the great Admiral Horatio Nelson disobeyed orders and smashed the French fleet and established the ascendancy of Britain, and we had Pax Britannica, laws of the seas, and then that baton was passed, or as Americans would say, baton, I believe, was passed to...
Pass the baton,
Baton to the US, which became the dominant power, of course, after Second World War, and imposed the laws of the seas. We are going to a new multipolar world, and the Pentagon likes using this term, and I find it useful, the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world to which we don't really have a precedent, because pre-1805, the ships were still wooden. There were no submarines. There was no air power. There were no nuclear weapons, no intercontinental ballistic missiles. All of that has since changed, and we are in a far more integrated world. My laptop, which I'm using to record this, was made in China. It's an American brand, but made in China. The tie I'm wearing is Italian. The mic I'm using is, you know, from some other place. So if we look at things we use in daily lives, the supply chains are extraordinarily complex. The global economy is inextricably intertwined. People are using German, Japanese, Chinese, American, all sorts of products. Services as well have now become disintermediated. Often the software being used in a Japanese car might have been written in Pune in India or somewhere else. So all of that complex global economy, I'm not saying that'll immediately collapse, but that'll face greater strains.
Well, I think we're seeing the world is so interwoven that it won't separate. It is in China's interest and the United States' interest to continue to trade. But it is also true that we are seeing a deglobalization of norms, practices, and associations and relations. Because of the specific stresses that we've talked about and these larger trends and so that we're living. So I'd like to make two points, which I think bring me to near the conclusion. And something I think, Atul, you can speak about firsthand, I can speak about it firsthand in the sense that I worked with and against people with the views I'm going to describe, but you grew up in a perspective that I'm going to touch upon. So something else contributing to this, the fracturing, is, of course, colonialism ended 75 years ago, largely 60 to 75 years ago. Yeah. But the attitudes don't change. America continues to struggle in 2024, vibrantly struggle. It is central to American society with the consequences, the legacy, the attitudes of America's slave history. Much change has occurred, great progress has occurred, but it remains central to most of the arguments politically and socially that America continues to struggle with. Similarly, colonialism has shaped the attitudes of billions of people to this day, so that having a there is a default acceptance in, quote, the global South, which we haven't talked about much, that the West equals imperialism, which had been true, and that therefore the normative system that I go on about all the time and that America has tried to champion is largely viewed, as the Chinese have stated, and state every day, a rationalization of Western white colonialism, and therefore a racist, unjust system. So there seems to be a de facto acceptance, I would say, that the bilateral, therefore the sphere of interest approach that China and Russia advocate, and India too, is a more just norm that we should move towards.
So I'll add a caveat to it, and the caveat is that the U.S. has undermined the norms itself. It was George Bush Jr. who attacked Iraq, despite not having the approval of the U.N. He walked out of, was it Kyoto, the Kyoto Climate Accords, which the previous administration had ratified. Can you imagine any other country, especially a small country, signing an accord and then saying, oops, sorry, we don't believe in it anymore? There might be an aircraft carrier by their shores if they did that. So bit by bit, the U.S. Undermined its own legitimacy by actions that were unwise. Now, to U.S. eyes, they weren't egregious, but to foreign eyes, they chipped away at this claim of normative order. Torture, something you opposed and wrote a book about, that hurt U.S. Legitimacy. So I would say that, yes, the developing world does view the U.S. as imperialistic, even Europe. Francophone Afrique, the French didn't exactly cover themselves with glory. But at the same time, the U.S. had a historic opportunity after 1991 because the Soviet Union collapsed and the communist gods proved to be false gods. And people like me grew up under socialism, which is why I'm so wary of the Soviets and by extension, to some degree, of the Russians and the Chinese. What happened is that a lot of people reverted back to left-leaning thoughts because they thought, my God, the new monopoly, oligopoly capitalism with none of the Teddy Roosevelt's trust-busting instincts is deeply unjust. And income inequality went up, wealth inequality went up, the promise of globalization turned out to be hollow. People felt that they were being sold dog shit as diamonds. And in a way, the left behinds have had their revenge, and not just in terms of the resurgence of other powers, but within countries such as the Netherlands, or for that matter, the UK, or for that matter, the US, the various working class people whom one of my friends called the swamp monsters in the UK, they've come out and they've come out to vote and they're having their revenge. So no one believes in norms anymore, not just outside the US, but even within the US, which is why when the US talks about the democracy agenda, and when President Joe Biden hosted the democracy summit and didn't invite Singapore, a lot of them were saying, hang on a minute, we've not had an insurrection and people rushing to Capitol Hill. Why are we out of this summit? And so there's been a progressive weakening of U.S. standing and by extension the standing of the West through their own actions. And that is something to remember too. There is anti-colonialism, but at the same time, there was unwise political decision-making in Washington, D.C. as well.
I don't fully share that perspective, but that's irrelevant really, because that is the perspective.
Just very quickly, two things there. The most recent ones, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a great idea, negotiated over a decade, thrown out like that by Donald Trump. Paris Accords, walked out. These things have consequences. People just lose faith.
Yeah, I would agree.
That trust is very hard to regain then.
I don't disagree with, certainly with that. I mean, and it's not significant to debate on points where I think I have a different perspective, because fundamentally that is what billions of people believe, perceive, and will act upon when they are able to, and they are progressively able to do so. So what is happening then? And as I said, it's not the Gaza war which is causing all of this, but it is another blow of the hammer or fracture, whatever metaphor you wish to use. So what I find is that, pardon me, the sphere of influence global system is progressively succeeding, and replacing the normative system from 1945. And why? And there are specific, the French have a good word, conjuncturale, which would be contemporaneous factors, and then long-term ones. And they're the Hamas-Gaza war, the reflexive lock-sync response by the Biden administration with Israel's policies, which are those of the far right, rather than a more rapid and substantive pressuring of Israel to achieve what U.S. objectives are, which is a two-state solution. Netanyahu's continued hold and defining Israel power and policy, the ascendance
although it might be fair to note that divisions in Israel are really flaring up. The cabinet has openly criticized the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, which hasn't really happened at a time of war before.
I think he might not be long for the world politically. And I've said, and others have said, people who know far more than I, that there are three, peace in the Middle East and actually a silver lining could come from all of this. But there are three conditions, and that would be one, that Netanyahu be removed and through U.S. pressure, probably, or assistance, Israel move aggressively towards a two-state solution. Two, that Hamas be removed, if not destroyed. I don't think it can be destroyed, but it can be removed and replaced by a more rational, less defined by destroying all, killing all the Jews perspective, leadership for the Palestinians. And then three, some international support structure to provide the funds for reconstruction and the building of a true two-state solution, which is still just possible, given what the far right in Israel has done on the West Bank by taking so much of the territory. And those, if those three conditions were met, then a lasting sort of broad, sunny uplands, as Churchill talked about it, future is possible. But each, the first two are, no one has been able to succeed. I'll continue with why, what's happening in the world as a result of this. I think I started to say, the, or I mentioned before, the ascendance of an isolationist and truly fascistic Republican leaders and party and population in the United States. China.
By this, you mean the continued dominance of Donald Trump in the Republican Party?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Trump is, he's cause and consequence. You know, he's, without him, and long before him, there were fascists and isolationists very influential in the United States and in the Republican Party. One shouldn't forget, and it was not an isolated event, that Madison Square Garden was sold out in 1941 by American Nazis for a rally. That was not an isolationist event, an isolated event. Other factors are the astounding and continuing rise of China to truly superpower status, the rise of Iran and other regional powers in their, for all the problems that Iran has, it is strong enough to send missiles to Pakistan if it feels like it, and it does. The assertiveness, not the rising power of, but the reassertion of imperial international heavy-handedness by Russia. And then one that we haven't talked about at all, but I used to talk about a lot because it was so central to my work on counterterrorism years ago, the progressive decentralization of power globally because of technological and ideological evolution, which means that even non-state actors, the Houthi, will, they're a state really, but Hamas, is that a state? You know, and a terrorist group is not a state, and an individual
and
is not a
state.
And by
the way, Iran has struck a non-state actor in Balochistan. They have struck Jaishul Adl, so which is a Sunni militant, or Sunni and Baluchi separatist organization that operates in southeastern Iran. So yet another non-state actor has caused this.
But all of these non-state actors now have increasing power. It used, 2,000 years ago, one man could kill Caesar with a knife. 400 years ago, one man could blow up the Houses of Parliament with gunpowder. And today, one man or woman can destabilize entire states and international systems by blowing up a bus or possessing a biological weapon or an ableistic missile. And all of these things make the normative system harder to maintain, the rise of sphere of influence more likely, destabilization not just more likely, but almost certain. So that we're, I think the questions raised, I know by my colleagues 20 years ago about what will the post war order look like, and there were various scenarios. I think we have probably the answer, which is that we're going to have international trade and agreements when it suits each state within the framework of a sphere of influence or regional bloc system, with the global south playing both sides to its national advantage, which ultimately leads to strengthening the sphere of influence system as opposed to the normative one. And that's where I come out from looking at what's happening in the Red Sea.
So what you're saying very much applies to pre-World War I, a sphere of influence, many empires, some of them tottering, great internal tensions, people, or leaders rather, sleepwalking into war, and ultimately a Gavrilo Princip firing a pistol, or was it a revolver, I don't remember, but killing Prince Archduke Ferdinand and triggering World War I. So it seems we are back to the future, back to exactly 100 years ago, a similarly unstable world. But hey-ho, women have the vote. There is universal healthcare so far in Western Europe.
In the United States, thanks to Barack Obama.
Okay, well, in the U.S. too, apparently. Yeah, although it costs a lot, it costs an arm and a leg.
That's another issue. But everyone should pay something.
Yeah, and on the whole, the world is definitely better off, better fed, taller, healthier than 100 years ago. But the instability is back, and one can hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And on that note, it's bye for now.
Till next time.